everybody. I'm Matt, and I'm an alcoholic.
Matt.
And I guess it was about 8 or 9 years ago. I was at Serenity House on a Sunday morning meeting, and I had my sponsor's search narrowed down to two people. And one of those people were not Terry Dunn. But I was at a meeting, and he said something that I could relate to. And I did know his wife, but I did not know him. And I called him and asked him to be my sponsor. He had no idea who I was. And he's been my sponsor ever since. But, you know, Terry doesn't tell me what to do. He shows me what to do. Whenever I call him with a problem, he doesn't really give me an answer. He tells me to pray about it. Every time I go to a meeting, well, not recently, but most of the time when I go to a meeting, he's there. He doesn't tell me to do service. I just watch him, and all he does is service. He's definitely changed my life. He made me get out of myself in the beginning of this program when I wouldn't talk to anybody. And I'm a single parent, and him and Leslie treat my children as though they're their own, and especially lately things I've been going through. Leslie, who is not Terry, but Leslie's helped me out tremendously. And I'm sure most of you know Terry, but with that, I'll introduce you to Terrence Dunn.
Hey, good evening, everybody. My name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic. I appreciate the kind words, Matthew. I will say one thing. One of the huge benefits of sobriety is that we get to meet new people all the time. And when you begin to sponsor guys and fellowship with people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's they say recovery's you know, a world full of hellos and goodbyes. And, you know, I agree with that. We meet a lot of people, and we also have to say goodbye to a lot of people because they don't make it. But one of the things that I cherish the most is that of the men that I sponsor, I develop a friendship with them. And, you know, and most of the guys that I sponsor today have been, you know, with me for a while. And it's just more than a sponsorship. And that's one of the gifts that sobriety's given to me, because when I was out there using, I didn't have a whole lot of really close friends. I didn't have friends that could come up to me and say, hey, you know, what you said to me, you know, helped me, or, you know, it kind of hurt my feelings. And, you know, the deepness that I feel with men in this program because of AA has allowed me to have a relationship outside this program, which is what this program is all about. For me, recovery is about getting out and getting back into life. When I was born and grew up, I grew up in a really nice family. I came from, I wouldn't say super well-to-do, but we were probably upper middle class. I was born in Ohio, and I was raised outside of Columbus, Ohio, in a town called Worthington, Ohio, and moved down to Georgia in the late 70s. I went to high school here, and from high school I went to school in New Orleans. And New Orleans was a great place for an alcoholic or a budding alcoholic to go to. A little bit about my brief history, just to tell everybody and people that have heard my story, I don't have a scripted story, so you're going to kind of get what you're going to get. This is the very first time, I'm sure it's the very first time for all of you, that we're sitting around at a speaker meeting and I can only hear myself. I'm chatting here and the only thing going on is I hear myself and I hear my dog kind of whining, and that's it. This is a little unique, but it's still the fellowship, and it's still a way for me to say what I always say, and that is, if I can share something tonight and one person says, if that guy can do it, I can do it, then guess what? I've done my job. I've completed the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I've carried the message to another alcoholic. And that's kind of what my purpose is tonight. I'll share this with you. I didn't start drinking real heavily until college. My drinking career in high school was probably like most of us. I enjoy beer. We would go out on weekends. We'd have beer. But I distinctively remember the first time. I was not the alcoholic that had a drink and said, "Oh my God, my life is changing." The warm feeling going down. It wasn't that for me. It just wasn't. We sat around before a basketball game, a high school basketball game, about six of us, and we bought at a convenience store, if anybody remembers this, a little 8-pack of 7-ounce Miller Ponies. They made 7-ounce beers. And six of us drank those things. And we drank it just because it was like, it's time to, you know, it's the thing to do. And we went to, it made us feel cool. The one thing about it is that we had six guys that shared that 8-pack, and I was the one guy that had the extra beers. So maybe if I had some foresight, maybe I knew that maybe I was heading in the direction that I ended up landing in. My grandmother was a recovering alcoholic. We didn't know it until she died in the late 90s. But she used to tell me throughout high school and throughout college that, you know, Terry, you drink a little too much. You need to keep an eye on that drinking. And I would just laugh her off, just saying it's kind of what we do. And that's what we did. But drinking in New Orleans took on a whole new life. For me, my alcoholic tendencies started the very, very first day I arrived on campus. I went to class, or I didn't go to class. My parents left, and we had an orientation that night. One of the fraternities had a party. And I remember nothing other than going to the party. I do have pictures, and if I could find them, I'd show them. But there's a picture of me laid out on my dorm bed with shaving cream all over me and permanent marker where they drew eyes and glasses and mustaches and beards and all of that on me because I was just completely knocked out. My drinking career at Loyola was that. I was a blackout drinker most of the time. I don't ever remember when I crossed that bridge, as they say. I have no clue when that happened. All I know is that I was an alcoholic drinker in college. I got through school. I met a woman while I was in school there. She eventually became my ex-wife. We had a great time in school. She was a partier, and we enjoyed each other's company immensely. But I was beginning to, you know, do what a lot of alcoholics do. A lot of alcoholics, we tend to start pulling away from those who might think you drink too much. We have a tendency to want to hang with those that don't say you drink too much. I was starting to have that kind of character where I was beginning to, people were questioning the way I was drinking, and I'd get very defensive, and I would ask them, you know, well, it's not any more than you're drinking, and that's just the way it was. But that was the kind of the beginning of a pattern that would get progressively worse as I went on through my life. So my ex and I, Michelle, we got married right. We both graduated. We got married right out of school, and we moved to Atlanta. My family was still here, but she was from St. Louis, and her family was in St. Louis. And one of the things they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that as alcoholics, we'll do crazy stuff to try and, you know, get away from drinking, so to speak. And one of those things was Michelle thought it was a good idea. She wanted to go back home to St. Louis, and I didn't. I wanted to stay here. I had a good career here. But, you know, happy wife, happy home, right? So I made a decision to file for a transfer with the company I worked for, and I remember distinctly to this day, my boss said, "Terry, wherever you go, there you will be. Things will not be any different up there than they will here unless you tackle the demons within yourself." And I took it for a grain of salt because at that time I was 27 and I wasn't really didn't care what most people thought about me because at that age you kind of know what's going on. So we moved to St. Louis. We had our first daughter. Lauren was born here in Atlanta in 89. And then when we moved to St. Louis in 1990, Michelle was pregnant with my middle daughter, Megan. And it was a pretty good life. There was, you know, the Carters partied, I partied. It was, you know, everything revolved around family events, but there was always alcohol involved. And it was extremely acceptable to drink and get drunk, but as long as you did the things you wanted to do. But as a result of my drinking, because I drank differently, our relationship began to change, and it began to kind of fall apart at the seams. It took a few more years, but in 1994, I decided that I wanted to go back to being a single guy so I could party like I used to, and I didn't want to be married anymore, and I divorced her. And when that happened, I went to a whole new level of use. I all of a sudden got involved with a bunch of guys that we drank every night, every weekend, and we drank to excess. And on top of it, we brought in a whole bunch of outside substances, a whole bunch of outside issues, and we did those alcoholically, as they talk about. I'm from a generation that does a whole lot of other things, but I am a guy that respects the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I always identify as an alcoholic. And one of the things, I'll just say this, one of the things that I always like to tell guys is when they share in a meeting and you're an anda, when you say I'm an alcoholic and an addict, you don't need to say that. You just need to say you're an alcoholic. Nobody cares. Respect the traditions. AA needs to last. And in order for it to last, we can't muddle it. And that's enough of my preaching. So we partied like there was no tomorrow. And the drug use on my part really accelerated to I lost my job. I lost my marriage. I was bouncing from job to job to eventually to a point to in my life where I was actually living in an apartment in an area of St. Louis that I would never have thought I would ever live in. I was hanging with people that were involved in not only doing drugs, but distribution of drugs. And I got into a lot of legal trouble at that point, briefly, because I don't have much time to talk about my sad stories. We all know why we're here. My life became a wreck, and I had nowhere else to go. But briefly, what we started doing created a where I had to do some things. I was working for an insurance company where I wrote checks for insureds, and I would have these draft books, and I would write a draft out for a claim. Well, in one of our weekend drunken stupors, we decided it would be a good idea to set up some fraudulent claims so we could fund our drug business. And we did that. We set up these fraudulent claims. We wrote these checks against these things, and we were able to purchase drugs, and we started selling it. The problem is, when you're an alcoholic and you're an addict, I got involved in my supply. And when you get involved in it, you start kind of, you're not thinking very clearly. And push come to shove, a year later, a knock came on the door, and it was my boss and a few other high-ups are in the company I worked for, and they had some questions on some files of mine, and I basically looked at them, and I'm sure they looked at me, and I said, I have some personal problems that I'm trying to deal with. And they said, yeah, we think you do, and you're going to have to work on those on your own. And they took my company car, they took the company laptop, and they took all the files, and they left. And I thought that was the end of it. With that being said, I had no job anymore, but I had all of my partying buddies. So we just decided that we would continue to do this. My addiction kept going further and further. Alcoholism was beginning to really take, I could not go a day without taking a drink. I was waking up in the morning pouring a drink. Throughout the day, I was drinking. And the other issues kind of went to the next level to where we do the things we never thought we would do. Ended up finding a room with somebody who was looking for a roommate. I ended up stealing money from that guy, writing checks from his line of credit on his home in order to support my habit. And I did that successfully for about 5 months. So I'm going to bring you up to the time that I last used. My sobriety date is May 30th of 1997. And I remember it to this day. It was about 10:30 in the morning, and I had been out on a very, very long run. And that weekend, it was Memorial Day weekend, I had gone to a bank and tried to cash a check that I wrote to myself and signed by myself with my roommate's name to the bank to cash it. And the lady, in, you know, obviously a brilliant teller, looked at me and thought, this guy just doesn't look like he's on the up and up. And she said, do you mind if I have your license and I want to just go verify the signature? I'm like, absolutely, no problem. Well, when she turned around to leave, I bolted out the front door because I knew the gig was up. And I bolted, and what happens is that if you leave your license at a bank, they'll find you. And that's what happened. I got word of that, and somebody had said, hey, one of the best ways that you can get your life together is figure out a way to get into a detox center. Go to a treatment. Do something, because you can't get arrested in a treatment center. I thought that was a good idea. So that's what I did. So at 10:30 or so on May 30th, I knew they wouldn't take me in for being out, you know, on a 3 or 4 day cocaine binge. But I knew they'd take me in if I had alcohol in my breath, because they didn't want to have me go through DTs. So I had some warm bush beer in the bottom of my 1987 Toyota Corolla, which at that point was my house. And I drank those beers, and I walked into the Highland Center in St. Louis, and I said, I think I have a problem. I need help. And the lady at the counter said, you think? And she said, do you have any insurance? I said, yeah, I think I might. I had been bouncing from job to job to job. And when I went to the last job I was at, I hadn't been there in like 2 weeks, but I had insurance. So I found my insurance card, gave it to her. She called them up, and it worked. And she said, come on in. So I went in, and this is where my life changed. So what it was like was kind of what we're all like. It wasn't fun. It was fun for a while. There's a whole lot of other stories involved in that that if I had longer time, I could go into the deeper details. Needless to say, I created so much financial, emotional, and spiritual wreckage in my life. I had no idea where to turn other than to go into a treatment center, hopefully to hide from getting arrested. And that was my sole purpose of going into that treatment center. I must have called my ex-wife while I was there, because that evening, when I called her, because I remember the words, she said that, you know, we know what you've done. Everybody knows what you've done. You've stolen a bunch of money. He's going to, you know, file a warrant for your arrest. You're done. Nobody ever wants to talk to you again. Your family doesn't want anything to do with you. You're done. You're never going to see the kids again. In fact, you know, most people wish you were dead. And I kind of took that to heart a little bit and, you know, felt like, you know, that's probably about right. Maybe that would be a good solution. That evening in the treatment center, the phone rang. And back then they had pay phones on one side of the hallways and on the patient floors. And the phone would ring, and they would actually come down and or the call up to the payphone. Somebody would answer it and say, hey, you know, is Terry here? There's somebody on the phone. And while I was walking down that hallway, just as I passed, and I call this a God shot, the very first God shot I ever got. I was walking past that payphone, and as I walked past it, it rang, and I picked it up, and it was my father. And I haven't talked to my father at that point or my mother in a couple of years. And I said, Dad, and this is the final, I finally, you know, broke down and I told the truth. I said, Dad, I'm in big, big trouble. And he said, Terry, we know. Michelle's called us. We're on our way up to get you. It's going to be okay. And at that moment, I knew somehow, some way, deep down, I knew it was going to be okay. And my parents drove all night. They came up to St. Louis, and they came in, and they were going to check me out. We were going to head back down to Georgia. The problem is that what nobody told me out in the streets is that when you check out of the detox center, you can get arrested then, because that's what happened. I was checking out, and the securities guys with the Highland Center said, hey, Mr. Dunn, the St. Louis County Police are here to see you. So I was quickly, swiftly picked up by the county police. My mom got to see me arrested and put aside in the car, and I was whisked away to jail. And I was whisked away to jail, not for for all the other things I had done, but just simply for this check that I had tried to cash. It was a $300 check, and that was the only thing they knew about at that time. Well, when I got into jail, I was so fed up. You know, when you get to that point where you are saying, I will do anything to get rid of this, to do something different, that point of desperation, that no matter what, I just can't do this anymore. I was there. And when I was booked into St. Louis County and the detective came in to talk to me, I unloaded on him. I told him everything. Everything that he didn't even know about yet, what was going on. And he was, you know, I think he was more in shock than anything else. But at that time, my dad had gotten a hold of an old fraternity brother of mine who was an attorney in St. Louis, who got a hold of a criminal attorney who eventually got a hold of my dad. And that criminal attorney came into jail to find me, and he said, what did you tell them? And I said, everything. And he just was like, well, I'm not going to be able to help you, but I'll do the best I can. So what happened was that my father wheeled and dealed with Robert, who was my attorney, and said, you know, they talked to the detective, and the detective said, look, your son's not a criminal. Your son's got an alcohol and drug problem. He needs help. And we recommend that he gets help, and we're going to allow him to go back to Atlanta with you as long as he makes his court dates. And that was the beginning. So I thought, this is going to be nice. And I started feeling better. I had no intention of getting sober. I just wanted to get things fixed. And I got down here to Atlanta, and my parents basically said, here's the deal, young man. You need to find yourself a treatment center. You need to put yourself in it, and you need to figure out what you're going to do with your life. If you don't want to do that, we're just going to give you a one-way ticket. You can get on a bus, and you can head back to St. Louis. So I made a decision right there that rather than go back to St. Louis and live in my Corolla that was probably no longer there at the hospital parking lot, I made a decision to find a treatment center. And the first one I looked up, we lived in Tucker, was in Doraville. And that place was called Mar. I called Mar up, talked to a guy named Doug Brush. Doug Brush asked me to come in for an interview. I went in for that interview. I was going to be there for 90 days. I pretty much pissed and moaned about staying there for 90 days, that I had a lot of things I needed to accomplish. I was a very important person. I needed to get back to work. I needed to get back paying child support. I needed to do all those things because, you know, now I had at least, I want to say, 12 days underneath my belt sobriety, and I pretty much knew what I needed to do. I didn't really need all of this. It was way too, I just couldn't do it. It was going to take up too much of my time. I had things to do and get my life back together. And he said something to me. He said, Terry, if you will rebuild you, the world will fall back into place. And you haven't given a shit about your kids, your ex-wife, or your family, or your employers, or your friends for the last umpteen years. 12 days isn't going to make it better. And so I stayed at Mar for the 90-day treatment program, and I left 6 months later. I didn't leave 6 months later on good terms either. One of the things that I've learned about recovery is that, hey, we got to follow the rules of life. And one of those things was you got to follow the rules of a halfway house. And I couldn't do that because I liked the he and she. And I found a little girl in treatment, and we started dating, and we thought we were the AA couple of the world. We were going to get married and go to meetings and live happily ever after in this life of sobriety. And I look back at it now and I chuckle, but when I got kicked out of that for that, I kind of was like, it makes no sense. We're going to meetings, we're doing everything right, why are you kicking us out? And Rick McCain, who's the one that tossed me out, said, Terry, if you can't follow the little rules of a halfway house, how are you ever going to follow the rules of life? And that stuck with me. And I use that to this day, that it's important. The little things in our lives matter. It's the elephants we can deal with. It's the fleas that get me drunk. It's over and over and over and over stuff that gets me drunk. So when I made that decision to stay at Mar, I completed that first step. I said, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. You guys can get an idea that my life is unmanageable. All of you that are in this room and on this meeting know your life is unmanageable. So when you make that decision to do something else, we make a decision that says, I'm ready to do something different. And that opens the door. You know, we turn our lives and our will over to God as we understand Him. We make that decision. Steps two and three, we do things differently. And what happens is that for me, those steps didn't come over. They didn't happen overnight. They didn't happen right away, but they happened eventually. The things that I've learned the most, and it's is that, you know, recovery for me is you know, they talk about, Tim mentioned it in the beginning of the meeting, that we reestablish our relationship with God, and that our relationship with God is a result of doing these steps. We forget about the fact that, you know, this is what AA is all about. It's about bringing God into our lives to change what we do. We're told early on, change all your playmates, change all your playgrounds. Change, change, change. The spiritual awakening as a result of these steps is called change. In the appendix of the big books, nine times, the word change is mentioned. That's what the steps do. When I start implementing the steps into my life, change begins to happen. And when I change, I become a different person. And it's difficult. It's very, very difficult. Things don't get better overnight. I was told long ago that consequences follow me long into sobriety. And that was true for me. When I started doing the fourth and fifth step and writing down all of those things that kind of determined what kind of person I was, a lot of that stuff began to come up. And as that stuff was beginning to come up, and as I was getting into the point where I was going to have to go make amends, all of those issues, those legal issues that I had, started kind of coming to the forefront. It's kind of funny the way things work with God. When you're ready, He puts things out there. So what happened was is that I had done a lot of stuff, and at that point, a lot of things had come up. I had the insurance issue that we did. We had stolen a significant amount of money, and I had to go get sentenced on it. And it was 9 months into sobriety when I had to go to St. Louis and get sentenced. And this is my second kind of like a God shot. The attorney had called me and said, "Look, the best we're going to do is you're going to do 5 years, get a one-way ticket. You're not going to be able to come back, tell your mom and dad. You'll see him in 5 years. That's the best I can do. We got Moore McShane. She's a prosecutor and attorney. And, you know, this is what the prosecutor agrees to." So I went to sentencing, and for whatever reason, you know, I had a file. I had, you know, my recommendations from the treatment center. I'd gotten a job at that point. And all of these things were coming together from that standpoint, to where I was able to present myself to the judge as not the same guy I was 9 months prior, but that what Terry done was right at that moment, 9 months in. And believe it or not, you do change. And for me, she looked at me and she looked at the attorney and she looked at my attorney and she said, "You know, I'm not going to go with what you guys recommend. I think I'm going to go with a lesser sentence. Now, I'm not going to get him off with anything. I had to do a little jail time, but I got 5 years probation with a significant amount of fines." And I did that. I came back to Georgia. I went back to work. I started doing the things. I was going to a lot of meetings. I was working at a halfway house. I was sponsoring guys. I was doing all of those things. And lo and behold, life begins to take shape and form. And what happened was is that I remember, you know, the career I was in became, you know, went from, you know, kind of a stepping stone into a career to where I got into the sales end of it, and I was beginning to be fairly successful at that. I had met somebody in the rooms of AA, and, you know, that person I met in After my first year of sobriety, I had to wait a year to date her. And we've been together ever since. Leslie and I have been, we'll be married 19 years in July. We've known each other for 22. So that's a huge blessing from this program, that you can find somebody and walk that same spiritual path and still have that same feeling for that person today, which is really, really cool. But neither here nor there. So let me ramp up. 5 years into sobriety, I get a call. Leslie, we let a lot of people stay at our house, and one of the people she let stay in our house thought she, there was some jewelry that was taken, and she reported to the police. The police came, and the police interviewed that girl, and that girl said, well, you know, that guy's an old crack addict. You ought to talk to him. He probably stole the money and used it on himself. Well, that detective did do that, and what she found was that I still had an outstanding warrant up in St. Louis, up in Jefferson County, Missouri, that had come up in 1998. And keep in mind, I'd been back and forth to the courts, back and forth to St. Louis numerous times. You know, I'm married now. I've got a good career. I've reestablished a relationship with my kids. Everything was going well in my life, and all of a sudden, this thing comes up where I had a warrant, and this warrant was from the checks, the big claims checks that had finally, that the insurance company finally did their deal, and I didn't know what to do. She said, if you don't get this taken care of, I'm going to come and get him, and I'm going to put him in jail, and he'll sit and rot until he gets these things cleared up. So I called my old attorney, who wasn't practicing anymore, but he put me in touch with somebody else. And that attorney called over to Jefferson County, and he said, yeah, there's a warrant for you. It's active. And he said it's a $35,000 bond, and you need to get over here, up here, and take care of it, because you do not want to get put in jail in Georgia. It'll be 10 days before you ever come up here. So I drove up that weekend. I called my ex-wife and said, hey, Michelle, the kids want to have a surprise weekend with their dad. I got to come up there for some business. And so I drove up there, and I went in on Friday. I went into the Jefferson County Jail, turned myself in. Detectives came down and they said, this warrant, and this was in 2005. He said, this warrant's 7 years old. What are you doing here? And I said, well, you know, of course we do what we do. Told them I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor, because that's the only reason I went up, is because Dennis said, you need to go. You have to go. Told me I needed to come up here and turn myself in no matter what the consequences are. They kind of scratched their heads and said, wow, that's kind of weird. Anybody would turn themselves in, but whatever, come on in. And they booked me. And I was only in jail for a few hours, but being in jail sober and being in recovery for a long time at that point, you know, 5+ years, it was not fun at all. But I got sentenced once again. I had another 5 years probation. I had a bunch of restitution to make. And I thought, well, this is bullshit. I'm doing all the right things. I'm sponsoring guys. I've got a good career. I'm really going along this narrow road. And I remember when I was driving home from St. Louis, and it's like a 9-hour drive, I told Dennis, I said, Dennis, you know, I don't understand this. And he just point blank said, Terry, did you steal the money? And I said, yes, I did. And he hung up the phone. And that kind of made me realize I was really upset and I was pissed that consequences truly follow us long in sobriety. But had I not been working steps, and I have not gotten into some of the things that really matter of this program, the actual work of the program, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the program, is that, believe it or not, even though I was still just kind of seething about all of these injustices that were done to me, I had realized that I didn't want to take a drink. It never occurred to me to go take a drink over any of this. And I thought back over the last, at that point, 7 years, we had been through a lot. Been through marriages, we've been through ups and downs with finances, just you name it. You know, and not once did the thought of drinking ever come up. And you know why? It's because I was in the middle of the boat. They say the winner, the meeting makers make it, Winners never quit. Quitters never win. And that's why, is because no matter what is going on in my life, I got up every day. I said my formal prayers. I would have meditation with God, and I still do that to this day. I still talk to God. Sometimes I cuss at Him. Sometimes I yell at Him. God doesn't care what I do. He just cares that I talk to Him. That's all He wants. He wants that communication, and that's key. There's been many a times where I have no idea what God's will is for me, and thank God I don't. Because if I knew what God's will for me was, I'm like, I don't know if I want to sit through it that long to get there. It would be awful. But that's what AA teaches us. It teaches us to do things that we normally wouldn't do. It's change. Change is very, very difficult. Anything worthwhile in life or in recovery requires it to be like scraping your knees. It requires it to kind of, crawl across sandpaper sometimes. That's just part of it. But when you get to the other side and you look back that I did these steps and I'm working with others and I'm going to meetings and I'm being of service and I'm picking up the phone and I'm socializing, and no matter what's going on in my life, the fact that I don't think about taking a drink is an absolute miracle. How do you get from where we've been to where we are now? How did I get from living in a beat up Toyota Corolla to where I'm at in my life today? My life today is full of blessings. I have gone from being a $7 an hour employee to where today I own my own business. I employ 15 people, and we're going through this nightmare of a COVID virus trying to maintain how do we keep our doors open and keep people employed. And guess what? Every day God gives us just enough, just in time, all the time, as long as we remain close to Him. And remaining close to Him requires me to do certain things. It requires me to stay active in the steps. It requires me to do what I call my formal prayers in the morning, where I get down on my knees and I ask God to keep me sober. It also requires me, when I'm out walking my dogs, to do my meditation. Or if I don't do that, to do it at some point. And do it throughout the day. You have no idea how many times my life has been saved, or my mouth has been saved, by simply doing what the big book says. We pause when agitated. We take a deep breath. We relax. We ask God for the right idea, for an inspirational thought, along those lines. It's amazing how that works. And then when I go to bed at night, I do the same thing. And if I make good decisions today, if I pick up the phone, I'm bad at this, my sponsees will tell you that, I'm probably not the best sponsor you can get a hold of all the time just to shoot the shit. But I will tell you this, they will say, if they really, really need me, I'll be there for them. And we have that kind of a relationship. But the beautiful thing is that about with all of this being said and done, if I follow God's guidance and direction, I can get through anything. AA has given me a life. That's what it's about. I don't hide in AA. I don't use AA as my crutch and say, oh, I can't do that. I'm a recovering alcoholic, or I'm a recovering Catholic, or I'm a recovering Emotions Anonymous, or I'm a recovering whatever it is. Those are what the meetings are for. We got to get to the solution. The steps get us to the solution. If you're sitting in the problem all the time, you're not doing something you need to do. And for me, by being involved in all of these things, I'm in the solution. And I guarantee you, the decisions I've made today, the fact that I told Tim that I would share my story, the fact that I let people know that I was telling my story, the fact is that probably people on here probably say, who cares what he's saying? I'm bored as shit. But if you don't go take a drink tonight, I don't care. The point is that my life and your life can be really, really, really good because the decisions that we make today will dictate what happens tomorrow. I always say this. I've made really good decisions today. I didn't drink. I talked to God. I probably had a conversation with a sponsee or two. I've done a good job at work to the best of my ability. I haven't pissed anybody off, at least not today. And I'll go to bed tonight knowing that. And then when I wake up tomorrow, odds are very, very good I'm going to have a good morning. And I start it all over again. And that's the wonderful thing about recovery. But you got to get in it. Unfortunately, early on in recovery, middle of recovery, late stages of recovery, it's hard. There are parts of life that are hard. And we as alcoholics kind of take things to the extreme. When things are hard for people, it's way harder for us. For whatever reason that is, it just seems to be that way. When I'm in fear, I'm in way more fear than anyone else. And I'll say one more thing about fear, because I wanted to touch on that, but I didn't. I'm all over the place. Sometimes I go off like the dog in that movie and say, squirrel. But what I wanted to say about fear is that my sponsor today tells me all the time that projection, which is fear, projection is a useless and harmful exercise. It does us no good. AA is about staying in the moment. When we're in the present, we're in the moment. When we're looking backwards saying what I could have and should have done, I always tell people, well, don't should have all over yourself today. Because the past only guides us for things that we need to do now. The future hasn't come yet. We got a plan. You can't be an idiot and go through life and just sit there and say, God's going to take care of everything. No, he's not. He's not going to make you get a job. He's not going to make you pay your bills. He's not going to do any of that stuff. You have to take the action. Our heads are in the clouds, but our feet are firmly planted on this ground. You got to do shit in recovery that you don't like to do. And if you're not willing to do it, you're going to struggle. At some point, you begin to do things and you start liking to do it. And you're okay with change because you know that I've gotten through a lot of things and I'm going to go through a whole lot more. Odds are very good I'll get through it because I got a program. The 12 steps take care of everything for me. If you haven't figured out a way to use the 12 steps in every part of your life, I encourage you to do that. And one final thing that I'll say is that I encourage everybody here to stay safe and to pray that we get things going back again, because I am really, really, really tired of all the people on my golf course. It's way too crowded. I need it back to where it's just a few of us. Thanks for letting me share. Nothing more.